Welcome back to Pat Smart Talk with Steve-O. Listening to News Talk WLOB, 1310 AM. Not only is he a paperback writer, but he's a hard book writer, an e-book writer, and one of Maine's great authors. Please join me in welcoming William Andrews to the studio. Hi, William.
Hi, great to be here, Steve.
And I want to get to your recent involvement in terms of great literature, but you have such an interesting background. Why don't we start a little bit in the early years in terms of your work and where you went to school and how you ended up coming to Maine and your role in education as president of Westbrook College before was called University of New England. I want to cover all that. So why don't we start with where you grew up and what ultimately brought you here to Maine?
I grew up in Pennsylvania. I went to college in Pennsylvania, went to graduate school there. It's had a detour to Ohio, lived around the Philadelphia area, had a real need to get to Maine, used to spend summers here, and just started looking for jobs. I wanted to get to Maine first, and it didn't matter what I did when I got here, but I was lucky to get a job as president of Westbrook College, and we moved in, I guess, 1987.
So it was involved, your background in terms of vacationing, so you were familiar with Maine.
Oh, yeah.
And it was a targeted search.
Absolutely.
And targeted pursuit. It didn't happen by happenstance.
Not at all.
University in New Jersey called, you wouldn't have wanted to go to the Garden State.
I drive through a lot, but I wouldn't have stopped. No, Maine was the destination.
Oh, that's funny. And talk a little bit about, everyone now is familiar with University of New England. I think in recent history they've done some really interesting things in expanding their curriculum and investing in infrastructure. But prior to being University of New England, it was called Westbrook College, right?
Well, Westbrook College was founded about 1831, I guess. It's a very old institution.
Right.
It was a seminary, so-called. And then it became a junior college for women, and then it became a co-ed and four-year over all this over a fairly long period of time. And University of New England actually was the result of a merger between St. Francis College and the Osteopathic College. So they were a merged institution down in Biddeford, and we were a small, long-standing college, much smaller than UNE in Portland, though the name is Westbrook College, but it's actually in the city of Portland.
Right.
And but too small to really survive independently. So the board and I began there looking around, trying to see if there was a way we could connect with another institution and pull our strengths. And we found a happy marriage with the University of New England. We had some programs that they didn't. We had some things that they didn't financially. We had a Portland presence that they didn't have. So it was a good mix, and it was a good merger. And as you said, it's taken off since, and they're certainly doing terrific things in this, particularly in the healthcare area with their dental school and pharmacy school, and that builds on their strengths plus the strengths that were sort of in place there at Westbrook. And a lot of it is now in Portland, which is a good location.
Great. Early in your career, it looks like in the late 70s, you were dean of academic affairs, Philadelphia College of Textiles and Science, now Philadelphia University, and then from there, you came up to Westbrook, long time in the world of academia. And
maybe too long?
No. My thing is maybe not long enough. What was the impetus after spending so much time? I had a brief intersection in terms of teaching. I was an adjunct professor for 9 years. And for me, it was one of the most enriching periods of my career. I was living in Atlanta at the time, and I was heavily involved in sports business and marketing. And University of South Carolina called one day and said, we want to make you an adjunct professor. And I said, well, that sounds great. And then I taught at Georgia State and guest taught at Emory and Clark Atlanta University. And I miss the environment. I miss being on a campus. And I always say that in the eight or nine years I taught undergrad and grad, I probably learned more from the experience than what I exported, and it helped me professionally. Talk a little bit about the scope of your involvement with both teaching and as an administrator and running colleges and what that experience was like, and then talk a little bit about how you think our education system may be a little different today and thoughts you have on that.
Well, I think you were on the sweet side of it, teaching. That's the fun part.
The administration, and dealing with all the people and the finance. And
well, there's some fun to that too, but it can get a little bit trying. And things have changed a great deal, as you pointed out. And I loved teaching. In fact, after I left Westbrook, while I was president of Westbrook, I actually taught a course, which was not easy to do, but I loved the contact with students. And after I left the college, I taught for a number of years as a part-time person in a couple of places. Keep my hand in it. That's the fun part. The administrative part of it, the managerial part, the leadership part has gotten much more complicated. There are lots of more regulations, federal and state regulations, even for private institutions. And fundraising is the name of the game. That's what you really do, particularly as a president. And there's a lot of pleasure in fundraising. There's nothing like coming home from a fundraising trip with somebody's check in your pocket because you know that you've done your job that day. But on the other hand, it can get a little tiring because you're
asking for money is an awkward enterprise.
Well, I don't mind it. A lot of people said that, but I actually enjoyed it because if you believe in what you're selling, if you can say, this will help the library, this will help a scholarship, this will help some kid from northern Maine who might not get to come to Westbrook. It's fun. If you don't believe in what you're selling, I think it could be difficult. And I think most people wear out. If you look at the length of time college presidents serve, it's getting shorter and shorter at one institution because people just get tired of that side of things.
It was actually just announced today that Paul Ferguson, the president of University of Maine System, just resigned. He is going to university out in Indiana. I don't know if it was Ball State or I should actually have the detail, but he was only here since, to your point.
Yeah, it was a very short term.
He was here since 2011, and it was just in today's newspaper that he gave his notice, and he's going to take a leadership role out in Ohio or Indiana.
Well, and if you look back before him, the turn, I think each chancellor, each president coming in there was – shorter than the one before. It's a demanding job, and it's a job that wears people out, and it does distance you from the fun part. It does distance you from the students, from the classroom. And if you're in a big university or even a large size college, you really can't stay in touch with students. You see them, but you're the president, they're the students, unless you can get in the classroom. And as I said, I was lucky to do that at Westbrook. But it was a hard thing to do because you always didn't know when you were going to get that call and you needed to go to Boston to talk to a donor and you had to cancel class or get somebody else.
We actually had the president of Bates in here a few months ago, and she was a really interesting lady, and she was talking about she thought one of the most interesting and fertile places for student interaction was the cafeteria.
Oh, absolutely.
And she said if you really want to have interesting conversations and you really want to engage students, do it in an environment that is kind of open and interactive and people are feeling good and they're eating and talking. And
there's nothing like food to open people up. And when I was at the college, any day I was on campus, I had lunch in the cafeteria.
So let's move on in terms of your career, in terms of teaching and in academia. Oh, before my fault, I wanted to ask your thoughts about the juxtaposition from when you started in Philadelphia College and Dean of Academic Affairs to what you think in today's realm, specifically digital education. And where you think education is heading based on your experience and your significant background and experience. And obviously here in Maine, there's a lot of financial pressure on both the university systems. USM went through and they're still going through really a very challenging time. They had a plan to cancel some programs and lay some faculty off. There was an awful lot of pushback. But the economics of education have changed. Government support has constantly reduced over the last 30 years. More of the burden is going on to the students themselves. Student debt is up. The curriculum itself, I think, is changing a little bit where people can learn more online. I think the classroom campus experience is invaluable for the human interaction. But like every other business, there's evolution and change. What's your feeling in terms of here in Maine, both the educational options we have And do you think education will look significantly different in 20 years, partly driven by technology and kind of remote learning?
Well, you've just listed most of the reasons why I'm glad not to be in the business anymore. It's changing so rapidly, and if I knew the answer to where it was going, I'd package that and sell it in some way, because I think that's the real problem right now is the incredible uncertainty, and of course uncertainty also is opportunity too.
Right.
But just the things that you've mentioned are absolutely true. The erosion of the campus experience, I think, is one of the greatest losses that we're going to have, that you learn by going to the cafeteria, meeting someone from another country, someone from another state, someone you didn't know before, and that kind of thing. If you're sitting in front of your computer, you're just not getting that. On the other hand, it's a lot cheaper to have that online experience.
Yeah, and the infrastructure.
There are people who can't come to campus, who can't afford to, can't take the time, need to work on their own. So there are tremendous good things about the technological aspects of higher education now. But I do think it is eroding that experience, and I'm afraid down the road we're going to have a lot of people who, just don't have the capacity to understand other folks, to get inside their head. And they will have learned things, quote-unquote, online, but they will lack that ability to interact, the ability to see things from someone else's point of view, which is one of the absolutely critical parts of education.
It's kind of the empathetic connection between humans interacting with humans,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, precisely.
Well, one of my big...
But I think the financial pressure is driving it that way. Come on, if you can go online, pay 1/10 or 1/20 of the cost, how many people are going to opt to do something else? There will always be people who go to high tuition elite institutions,
right,
because that's a whole other game. But for folks sort of trying to prepare themselves for a career, to sort of get a leg up and so on, it's going to be awfully tempting. Who can blame them to try to do it cheaply and online? And many of the online opportunities come from for-profit institutions, and that has tremendously changed education. When I was in it, you barely heard of the University of Phoenix's and institution, Kaplan University, and those for-profit institutions. Now they are growing, and they're, to be honest, sucking up enormous amounts of federal financial aid that is not going to kids going to public institutions. So the landscape has changed, and there are a lot of bloody bodies out there on the landscape. And as I say,
yeah,
it's one of the reasons I'm glad not to be in the business anymore, because I don't know where it's going.
Yeah, but one of my fears, and my wife and I, we have three children, and they've gone through the Yarmouth school system where I live, and this is the point where I'll put in the asterisk that says I'm going to sound like my parents now or my grandparents, talking about the Beatles being awful. But what you see now these days, and not just in the abstract, but, in my living room last night, are kids holding iPhones, Instagramming, texting, tweeting, and the communication is moving faster, and there's more data being transferred through the technology, through the instantaneous digital connections that is part of day-to-day life. But there's, in my opinion, there's less and less real human interaction, empathetic connection, real looking somebody in the eye. And, our oldest daughter, Emily, who's 23, who's just a wonderful young lady and a great education. She's starting school for other classes next week, actually. But I remember a year or two ago, I was talking to her, and we live in Yarmouth, and I was asking her if she had talked to her cousin who lives down Scarborough lately. And I said, well, yeah, have you talked to your cousin lately? Have you talked to Erica lately? And she's like, oh, yeah, she's doing great. And I said, well, how does she sound? Oh, everything's going great. And I go, when was the last time you saw her? And she was like, what do you mean? I go, sat across from her. And she goes, oh, it's been years. I go, okay, when was the last time you spoke to her on the phone, which is a little bit closer in terms of a human, voice and inflection and nuance? She goes, oh, it's been years. I go, well, what do you mean you talked to her last week? On Facebook, I posted some. You wouldn't know if, there's no nuance to a Facebook posting. So if you type to somebody, hey, how you doing? And the person says, fine, they could have lost a leg in a ski accident. They could have been going through a horrible divorce. They could be in the middle of some great human tragedy. And things are happening so fast that people aren't stopping as much. And I think I don't think it's a case of just the conveyor belt of our civilization moving faster. I think we're losing something in these kind of, you know, human interactions or transactions that don't have the depth that I think are meaningful for day-to-day life.
Oh, I couldn't agree with you more. The question is, we're not going to stop it, so what are we going to do about it? I mean, that's it's here. It's there.
We I want to stop it. I know, but I want to stop it. I want to stop it.
You're the man there putting your hands up against the technology saying it's not coming. Well, it is. It's there. And as you say, when I see kids glued to those things, just sitting there doing that, I'm thinking,
in a beautiful
what are
park.
They missing?
You and I can go out to the most beautiful park in Portland or anywhere through Maine. We can go anywhere. And instead of people taking enough time to look around and, you know, nature's beauty, you find people in this robotic trance bumping into each other, texting and tweeting, and many times just meaningless words. But we're all on this kind of this hamster wheel where if we don't know what's going on with all of our friends, and if we don't share that I had egg salad instead of tuna salad today, that there will be some gap of knowledge that's empty in the universe, so we must fill every gap, as opposed to just walking around and looking at the ocean and enjoying day-to-day life.
Well, I guess the thing is, how do we convince young people that there's a better alternative to that? What, you know, what do we offer them that will draw them away from that? And that goes back to education again. It goes back to getting people into art museums or getting them to walk beaches, whatever, to get a direct experiential feel for things instead of all this mediation that has to be by text. I was having dinner. My wife and I were having dinner with some friends the other night before a symphony in Portland, and the other woman, the other couple, is a teacher, and we were talking about this very thing. And just for the heck of it, she picked up her her iPhone and she texted me. I was sitting absolutely where our elbows were touching. She texted me, and I texted her back, and she said, "Do you realize this is what goes on all the time with the students? What do you do?" And I asked her, and she said, "I try to be a very engaged, energetic teacher, draw them away and get them to see that, dealing with themselves, with each other and with me is a lot more fun than sitting there texting." I said, "Does it work?" She said, "Sometimes."
I am.
We just have to keep at it, I guess.
Well, and my fear goes beyond just kind of the academic platform. My fear is it goes more into economic issues in terms of, you know, us in America and in Maine competing in a global platform. And we're graduating so many kids, in my opinion, I am the world's biggest fan of education, but I tend to take a broader view on education. I think education is what you and I are doing right now. We're exchanging ideas. We're talking. We're sitting here. I think education is watching something on the Discovery Channel about something that happened in Central America, or talking about the Panama Canal Treaty and what's going on and how the economics of trade have changed. And many people in our society, and I think I'm critical of this part of it, look at education in a very literal and very narrowly defined way of, hey, do you have an education? Meaning for 4 years, did you go to a group of buildings with rolling hills from September and May? Did you memorize a bunch of stuff? And did you get some sort of certification at the end that is supposed to be symbolic of learning and knowledge or wisdom? That in many cases, we've accepted the symbolism instead of going deeper into the intrinsic specialness of enlightenment and education, which for many people going to university is the right thing to do. For many people, learning can take place, and I believe it should take place every day of our lives. And I just wish we could get that message across, because I interview so many young people. They come in, they go, "Well, here's my education. I did this." And then I ask, "Well, in the last 5 years, what have you done to educate yourself more?" And sometimes I get these blank looks like, "What do you mean? I went to school. I got a diploma. Why would I want to be more educated?" It's like, why? You're a human being on the planet flying through space. And, you know, you want to have greater understanding, greater connection to the human enterprise.
But they don't see any immediate payoff in that. That's part of the problem.
I know.
And that's one of the things that's affected higher education. It's the vocational drive. You know, when I went to college, and perhaps it's not true when you did since you're younger, but no one thought of majoring in something they were going to get their life's work out of. You were a liberal arts major. Everyone was a liberal arts major. You might say English, history, whatever it is. And then later you might focus in a bit, and you might get a job in a company, and then you might go back and get an MBA. You might do, you know, that kind of thing. But now, I don't have the figures on top of my head, but I think it's something like about 80 to 90% of students are start college enrolling in business administration or nursing or recreation management. Or I'm not knocking those fields at all, but not right. the liberal arts.
Yeah.
So it's all vocational. You ask, when parents come to visit a college with their students, they say, is she going to get a job? And how much is that job going to pay? And you'd like to say, don't think about that now. Let the kid grow up and figure out what life's about.
Because if kids can learn how to learn,
yeah,
right?
Precisely.
And if they can learn in an environment that stimulates their curiosity, that's what I look for in employees and people that I work with professionally, because you can train people in different areas. You can instruct people to excel in different disciplines if they have an operating system of curiosity, thoughtfulness. You know. But if a person graduates with a degree and it's so narrow and so technical,
Of course, some of the people that you hired won't have been to college, but they'll have that openness. They'll have that love of learning. They'll be interested in things. And why not hire them instead of the narrowly educated, quote-unquote educated?
I've got a confession for you, by the way. We have William Andrews here in the station. You're listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O, and he's talking to – I never went to college. And maybe that's part of my passion for education.
Good for you for valuing it so high.
I couldn't value it. I grew up in Needham, Mass, right down the street from Wellesley College, the infamous women's.
Well, they wouldn't have taken you then anyway.
So. I tried to get in, though.
I'm sure you did.
I tried to get in. I could tell you some stories.
Just on the weekends, probably.
Well, it's almost like you were there. My friend John Rudberg and myself and Jeff Mont, we used to, Friday night, let's drive over to Wellesley. And this was back in the 70s, right? So there was AM radio. We were driving in a Ford Maverick. And we thought back then that driving through the campus of Wellesley College would either make us smarter or the Wellesley gals would jump into the car and go, we want to hang with you guys.
Probably the latter. It was what you're really interested in.
Every night at about 11, we ended up going, well, let's go to Howard Johnson's and have some blueberry toasties. that was my my entire experience at Wellesley College. Let's talk a little bit. I could talk about education for hours and hours, but really interested in how you transitioned from being an educator and an administrator to really pursuing your love of writing. And in addition to my love of education, my second great love is literature and writing. And I wrote a column for many years, and I enjoy it as just a pastime. So talk a little bit about what moved you into that area, and then we'll talk about a couple of the books you have out and where you're going with writing.
Well, given your love of literature, Steve, or love of writing, you know that it's fun in its own right. Doesn't matter if you publish something. It's fun to do. Well, after the merger at Westbrook College, I was able to sort of step away from that role. And because I'd been a faculty member way back in my career, been mostly an administrator, I never had a sabbatical. It's one of the great things faculty members get is time off to pursue something.
Right.
I never had. So I looked at the first year after the merger as my sabbatical before I decided what else I might want to do in life. And I've always wanted to write. I love mystery. I love almost any kind of novel, but love mysteries, read them. Always used to say, I could do that. We all have that tendency.
Right.
So I said, okay, Andrews, this is your chance. Here you are. You don't have anything to do. You're sitting up here in the mountains. It's the skiing hasn't started yet, so you better get doing something. And I started writing. And I wrote, I think, three really, really lousy mystery novels. Each one maybe a little better than the one before, but really lousy. And I, as I read them, I said, there's nothing here. But each one taught me something about how to do it. And so finally I hit on a concept. I was engaged at that time a lot with the Bethel Historical Society, which is near where we live up in Newry, near the Sunday River.
Right.
And I realized one day we got a handout from the director of the society. I was on the board there that described thefts from historical societies around New England. And it turns out there are a lot of thefts because a lot of small-town historical societies have very valuable objects. The revolutionary gun that someone left them.
Wow.
And it's in there. Security isn't good. Small places not protected.
Volunteers there.
Coming and going.
Yeah.
No security system on the weekends. So all of a sudden it hit me. Here's my plot. And so I began creating this fictional historical society with a fictional director and a fictional board, and it has some really valuable items in it that no one knew about, and they begin to go missing. And so that led on to the sort of filling out of the whole thing, and that was the first mystery called Stealing History, because the people who were doing the theft were, in a sense, stealing history. And that character and those people became then the platform for the second one called Breaking Ground, which involves a fundraising program and a new building that's going up. The Breaking Ground is, you know, the groundbreaking, right, for that building. So that gave me a chance to also to play around with my love of fundraising, which was sort of fun. And I've just about 2 weeks ago learned that my publisher, Island Port Press, has accepted the third in this series. And it's a series. There's a central character, a woman who's the director of the Historical Society, but is also really the solver of the mysteries, if you will. So she's an amateur detective, what they call in the business,
Williamson, right?
Julie Williamson. And so the third one has now been accepted by Island Port, and that will be coming out probably not for another year because they're backlogged on their publications, I'm happy to say. And I don't have a title for it, but so there are three now in this series. And, you know, the funny thing when you ask again about how did you get involved in this, when I've said I always wanted to try it, I think I underestimated. I know we all underestimate how it'll be easy, we think. Oh, yeah, I can do that. I read that. I read Ruth Rendell. So right. Now I can write a mystery. But you learn a lot as you go along. And it was throwing away the first three was a great idea. I would have been embarrassed if some friends read them and they were embarrassed for me. But every one of them taught me something. It taught me how to do dialogue, how to develop my characters by letting them talk about themselves and that sort of thing. So it's been great fun. Great fun.
Why mystery as a genre as opposed to, and you know, what great mystery writers inspired you that led you to kind of specialize in this genre of Ray?
Well, I like what the people who read these things a lot call the cozy. That is, it's a sort of often an amateur sleuth. It's set in a small town. Many of them are British, and the writers that I like a lot are people like P.D. James and Ruth Rendell and Martha Grimes and Elizabeth George, who are contemporary ones. And they involve often more psychology than blood. You know, you got to have a murder every now and then. You got to have some mayhem. But mostly it's about how people's minds work. And I like the idea of solving puzzles. And my heroine, Julie, is a puzzle solver. She does crosswords. She does jigsaws. And I don't do those things, but I like puzzles. I like to sort of go through the logical step of solving things. And I think what's appealing about mysteries, both to read them and to write them, is they're in a kind of a narrow space. You have the conventions. Certain things have to happen. And, you know, there's chaos at the beginning because there's a murder or a theft or both. And at the end, everything's put back together.
So the mystery is set up. You have to have the story that creates, yeah, there's a mystery, who done it or
who
where
done
this
it?
Happened,
yeah,
or who stole that.
But while you're answering that question, who done it, you're looking into people's characters and you're allowing people to analyze each other's psychology and do go through the lockstep sort of process of how does this clue lead to that clue and so on. And you know in the end it's going to be solved, unlike a lot of other kinds of novels where it's open-ended. You get to the end of it and you say, what was that all about?
Right.
A mystery has its beginning and end, it's set. And so it's easier, especially, I guess, for someone starting out writing like me, it's easier to work within the constraints of that than, you know, in a more wide open field.
Is the main character, Julie Williamson, modeled at, is it a composite? Is it a complete product of fiction? Or is there somebody in your life that has some of the mannerisms or some of the nuances of Julie that it's loosely modeled on?
Yep, all those.
Okay.
All the above in some ways. Well, because this started with a historical society, because it involves a historical society, a lot of my friends involved with the Bethel Historical Society look for themselves in these characters. But they really aren't there. They're composites and imagined. Sometimes, as you said, a kind of a mannerism or a personality aspect of someone I knew once somewhere else comes into it, but they're really invented, and that's the fun of it. I don't think it would be really a lot of fun to simply create a character, you know, who resembles you.
Right.
I'd rather take some interesting part of you and put it together and create a new character.
Well, if you want to put me in the next book, that's fine.
Well, you want to be the murderer or the murderee?
No, I don't know if I want to be either. I want to be kind of the benevolent local business person. In Yarmouth, I'm elected official. By the way, have you been to the Yarmouth History Center? Have you been to just up the road up in here in Yarmouth, Maine?
I don't actually know the Yarmouth History Center.
Yes, it's the Historical Society runs it, and it's actually only about a year old.
Oh,
and
no,
and you need to put it on your list of interesting places to go. This is an unabashed plug for the Yarmouth History Center. For years, it was in a small corner of our public library in Yarmouth.
Typical, yeah.
And it was. It almost, you know, the public library is going through a renovation now, but it was, you know, the library is over 100 years old. So it would be in a corner where there would be dust and cobwebs, and as you walk from one side to the other, the floor would creak. See, this almost writes itself for your novel.
Yeah. Creaking floors are
creaking
good.
Creaking floors. And then they did a fundraiser, and they took our old water district building, and we decided as a town to give them a favorable lease where they pay the grand sum of $1 a year to rent this old building, and they completely renovated it. In Yarmouth's case, you know, almost every town in Maine has such rich history because it's one of the first settlements and one of the kind of the landing point for our country and the kickoff of democracy, everything in New England. But in Yarmouth was one of the greater boat building locations 150 years ago, and then logging and timber. So, and then there was a trolley system that ran through Yarmouth. All these things that even, you know, I've been involved in town government for years, I had no idea, but it's this brand new renovation, and it's this really large history center. And not only is it relevant to Yarmouth itself, but anyone in the region, interesting in how, you know, great photos, great collections of artifacts. I hope we don't have a problem with stealing. Now that I'm alerted to this kind of epidemic, I'm going to have to let them know. But it's right off of Elm Street. And if you get a chance to go to the Yarmouth History Center, it's really enjoyable.
Well, I appreciate that tip. I will. One of the ways in which we promoted the first couple books was my going out to local historical societies, giving talks and having signings and readings and that kind of thing. And it's amazing how many they are, and you describe them very well. They're often over in a little room here or part of a library.
Right.
Some of them have a freestanding building, but it's only open the third Tuesday in July, that sort of thing. They're everywhere. And the people in them do a wonderful job of preserving history. So it's great to hear that Yarmouth has taken a step up from its.
And it's open every day, I think, and it's staffed, and there's a little gift shop, and there's a community room that's used for community activities, so it's really someplace pretty special.
Well, my publisher is in Yarmouth, right up the road.
I know,
here too, and so
Dean Lund, right?
Yeah, and so maybe we can arrange a signing at the Yarmouth Historical Center.
Please do. We have William Andrews here, who is an author and has been involved with writing and academic affairs. By the way, I should mention that anyone interested in his first two books, Stealing History or Breaking Ground, you can go to his website, www.WilliamAndrewsMysteries.com. And I am guessing that both titles are available on Amazon and bookstores.
They are. I especially encourage people to go to their independent bookstores and buy them. I know that Amazon provides a service, but it's great to have a bookstore. So if you can, and you'll find it at most local ones throughout Maine.
I know. I was reading a great op-ed from December of 2011, written by you. And the title is Buying at Local Bookstores Supports Literary Community and Local Economy.
That's right. And I think people lose sight of it. We're getting more and more, with the Buy Local campaigns, aware of the importance of doing that. My son's a commercial lobsterman. They have a saying down on the waterfront, buy where you tie up. That is, patronize the places that are right near you. If you tie your boat up there, buy your other supplies there. Don't go somewhere else because they're cheaper. And I believe strongly in the buy where you tie up thing. And
I agree.
The local bookstores. We're fortunate that a couple new ones have come into Portland just recently. So we now have several. And sure, you could get them on Amazon, but you can also get them, I believe, most of mine at the local stores.
I mean, well, let's stay on that local bookstore kind of theme. By the way, we had Linda Greenlaw here not too long ago, and she's also a well-known author and was at least, it wasn't her book, but she was a character in Perfect Storm.
Right.
Are we losing, talking about bookstores, I've always enjoyed going to bookstores and back in the day, record stores. Here in the studio, I keep albums and even 8-tracks on display to remember my, my
lost
past,
youth.
My youth of riding in a Maverick through Wellesley College, actually, yeah. With a Rolling Stones 8-track playing. But even bookstores, I read your op-ed, which was a very thoughtful piece, but you talk about not just the commerce of a bookstore and the transactions that can, but the human experience of interacting with other people, seeing other types of books you normally wouldn't be exposed to, in just the feel, the environment playing a role.
Well, it's really, Steve, what you said earlier about what the college at its best can do, bringing people together and learning the human interactions. And you go into a bookstore, you're not sure what you're looking for. You ask the person at the desk. That person recommends something else. A customer comes in and says, oh, by the way, if you're interested in that, I just read this. Before you know it, you're having coffee with them, right, and talking about things. And you end up, finding out about a book that you didn't know about, perhaps. So, yeah, they're a great institution. And I think are losing them, as we have with some of the chains going down and a number of the local ones dying, is a really sad thing. When the first of my mysteries, Stealing History, came out, and I did readings and signing around the state, we made a list of the independent bookstores that I went to. And when the second book came out 3 years later, we found 50% of those independents were gone.
Oh, wow.
And that's sad.
What do you think about e-books? And what do you think about both the trend and what it means for the industry and what it means for you as an author? And are your two books available in e-format? And what do you think about e-books and digital books?
Breaking Ground, the second, is in an e-book. The first one is not. I'm sure the third one will be both. I confess, I don't have a Kindle. I don't have I don't use that form. I also confess, all my friends do and think I'm a Luddite. They don't understand why I don't do it. So I've got to believe my friends are right and I'm wrong. But, I like to hold a book in my hand. I like the physical thing. I like to crack the cover. I like to turn down a corner page where there's a scene that I'm interested in. I know there are electronic ways to do that on e-readers. And, someday
it's
I'll learn, but it's not the same.
Every time when I buy a book, and I have a fairly extensive book collection at home, 1,000, 2,000 books, the first thing I do, I'll go to a bookstore, I'll buy the book, I'll write my name in the right-hand inside corner, because I think we all have this habit where somebody will say, hey, can I borrow the book? And they have the best of intentions, you have the best of intentions, but for some reason they always disappear. So I've taken to writing my name and then the date when I bought the book. And as I read through a book, if there's a passage or if there's just a combination of words, I'll go back to the front cover and just write the page, page 97,
right, yeah.
One of my favorite books, and it's obviously not a mystery, but Siddhartha by Hermann Hesse, for some reason, and that's taught, it's not a very advanced literature book, but there's something about the character development about Siddhartha and Hermann Hesse. I must have, 500 copies, and I used to give them out at school. But I have like a whole page of notes. On page 104, Govinda says to Siddhartha something about wisdom being omnipresent. And that's part of the experience of a book. I don't have that experience if I read it electronically.
Yeah, I'm with you on that, but I know here again we're probably on the wrong side of this. But I'll tell you one sort of small thing that's happened. We have some very good friends that we exchange books with, and it's an informal thing. We read our books. Oh, you got to read this. We'll take it to them. And they'll say, you got to read this. We'll take it to them. They've gone to e-books now, so they never give us any because we can't read them. So we give them all of our hardbacks.
That's funny.
We value their friendship anyways.
When in the younger days of William Andrews, who's in the studio here, what books or what authors? I know you mentioned some mystery authors that you enjoy now because they kind of speak to you and your specialty of mystery novels, but do you remember books in high school or pre-high school where you read something that you thought, this is a really interesting, for me, Hunter S. Thompson was Dr. Gonzo. He wrote in a style which was just so unique, and people talk about his famous book, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, but he wrote a book called Hell's Angels about spending time. And it wouldn't be considered great literature by many people, but it was a style of writing that I thought, it was just so different and so alive, it came off the page. Did you have authors that you felt the same way
yeah,
about?
Yeah, I guess for me, here again, I show myself of being quite superior in age to you, Steve. But for me, it was Salinger. It was J.D. Salinger. It was
right.
Catcher in the Rye. It was the Franny and Zoe stories. And it was Catch-22, the Joseph Heller novel, which was sort of, at that moment, really caught the absurdity of life. And yeah, both Heller and Salinger, I would say, were big.
How about Robert Pirsig? Did you ever read
Motorcycle?
Zen and the Art of Motorcycle.
Oh, yeah. Indeed. That was later in my – I mean, again, I was older when I read that. It probably didn't have the same kind of impact. And I guess the book that had the most impact on me, both as a young person, that I keep going back to probably every year or so, I reread it, is Thoreau's Walden,
right.
Which is, you know, not a novel. You know, it still speaks to me. And every year when I reread it, it speaks to me in a different way as I get older. You know, that experience of nature that the character has living out in the pond.
I was just down in Massachusetts and I drove by Walden's pond.
Yeah, it's there. It's small, but then it's a state park.
I know. I know. You don't expect it to be, you know, this huge, it was just this tiny little pond.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
The words that he used and the way he wrote, it was, he created magic in terms of literature.
I went to the woods because I wish to live deliberately. And I, you know, I value the woods a lot and I value living deliberately. And it sort of gets it all together.
Well, William, we've run out of time. I'd love to have you come back sometime. We could talk about either books, education, or a bunch of other subjects, I'm sure. And thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me. By then, I will have visited the Yarmouth Historical Center. We talk about that too.
We will talk about that again. Encourage everyone. We have William Andrews here. You can go to his website, williamandrewsmysteries.com. His first two books, Stealing History and the novel Breaking Ground, are available wherever you buy your books.
And also available, by the way, on islandportpress.com.
All right.
Publisher's website.
And they're a local publisher actually based in Yarmouth. So,
right.
You know, and we do like to support the local economy.
Buy where we tie up.
Exactly. Thank you so much, William.
Thank you.
You're listening to Time Smart Talk with Steve-O on News Talk WLOB 1310. We'll be back.